All right, welcome back, Rhetoric Warriors podcast. And I don't know, we're up in the 140 episodes. I've probably done 25 of them with my guest today. Dr. Dave Payne is back to throw some rhetoric back and forth, some tennis, play rhetoric tennis.
Drop some rhetoric on you.
Yeah. And I thought today, since I've been doing a ton of work in this lately, we're going to talk about the rhetoric of identity, which sort of dovetails into so many issues like the ideas of self versus other versus public identity and private identity. There's a lot in here. I've got a marketing company that is basically building public identities for business people right now. And it's interesting when you start doing that as a professional activity for people, basically, you know, you're a sophist building ethos for them, that they balk in so many places because they're not used to constructing their own identity on purpose in sort of, you know, very formulaic and very structured ways. So we're going to talk about that today. Rhetoric of identity. You've got some ideas about identity, don't you, David?
I have had. It was kind of when I was doing my graduate work, was kind of a buzzword, I think. Not too many people had really, I think, thought of rhetoric in terms of identity. But kind of the new sociologies were leading us down those roads. So I felt like I was kind of the first to try to sort some of those worms out. I thought a good bit about the difference between a classical idea of ethos or credibility or right, in a different culture, and in an oral culture, and kind of the notion of identity, which was, I think, everywhere, 70s and 80s,
right,
and then even to think about, you know, how is image different from that in a completely mediated environment. So I have not thought about updating that to the kind of work you're doing with computer. So I think, you know, somebody in normal culture doesn't think about their image. That's right.
Right.
Or their self, for that matter, in some ways.
Well, it's a new sphere like that has emerged. And I try to start people, you know, most people they don't spend their days doing theory work and theory thinking. But I try to start them with some kind of sense of, if this is the public world that we've been used to for so long, and this is the private world, like you walk off stage and now you're your private self again, where you've accomplished this a lot. Almost everybody has accomplished private self a lot. Very few people have done a ton of public selving, but now with the social media and digital media, there's this weird third space of public private, you know, where it's both. We're using our private life to put it out there on Instagram and showing as much privateness as we can, but it's still this weirdly public crafted version of us.
We've not had bedroom pictures of the prince before. This is new. Our courtship didn't involve those kinds of selfies, right?
Right. Well, and even all the exposures that celebrities are now, you know, experiencing constantly. Used to be you could hide, like the JFK affairs, right? They were hidden for years and years. And suddenly,
and now you have to have your own sex tape, right? So,
yeah. And the Bill Cosby thing, he was kind of rumored to have done this forever, but then he got outed on social media. And it talk about that has to be one of the biggest sea changes of identity in all history.
Sure.
Went from this massive hero to this horrible villain. So a lot there, a lot going on.
Oh, I think so. I think so. You know, when we're talking about people and their presentational self, right? Of course, now, once again, another buzzword is performative, right? Everything's either transactional, performative, or both, right? But so I think that itself bespeaks a kind of modern sophistic we would put all these things into. But if you work with folks, like I think we have observed about many things, people are not used to thinking about audience. And so I think the kind of the naive standpoint on self or identity, and the word identity, I think, is itself at the heart of this kind of confusion, where identity is by definition how you're known to other people. But part of the mythology, I think, of what I consider a kind of mythology, is of this interior self that needs to get out. So if you ask people, right, to talk about their identity, they think they're talking about their inner self. And how do I make that inner self known? So how to best represent this interiority, which is not really the same as manipulating your identity. So actors, of course, and people sophisticated about media are adept at, right, a technology of manipulating outside appearances. But your person walking around, you know, even when it comes to preparing your resume, people will kind of get how much stuff about myself can I get in there, rather than think about what does this look to somebody reading it with a certain set of criteria, a certain set of questions. So I think there's this kind of media and also a divide about how we're, you know, perspectival divide about how we're thinking about our identity that's out there. So yeah, in the age of identity, people are worried about finding their inner self, right?
Right. Well, that's the first thing I run into is the training people have up to this point with their self and their identity is not thinking of it as an asset, like a public asset or a persuasive asset. They've got a certain set of terminologies, certain set of instructions about how to think about the self. Like, I'm not happy. So there's an emotive dimension to the finding the self. Like, I'm not happy. Why am I not happy? How do I find happiness? And then there's that intellectual side of, you know, what fits with me and what doesn't fit with me? What can I claim? So there's all this dimensionality, and we don't really have the linguistic apparatus set up for people to be able to talk their way through it.
Well, you know, and Facebook is kind of training wheels for this too, right? So that you accumulate a certain number of likes or things, you know, things that you then you import to your page, your homepage. So I remember thinking a lot about this when it first became, God knows how long that was, right? To get your homepage together. So it was definitely when everybody got their computer, and then they started, you know, and there was all kinds of instructions about getting your homepage. So I think kind of the art that you're perfecting here sort of began with the homepage, right? And then on Facebook or MySpace or whatever, there was a kind of a, like I say, a training wheels technology there for accumulating a certain number of things that are identifiers. So you look, you know, I got my liking of my Patsy Cline or whatever link to that and to this, that family, whatever. So identity, public identity in that medium then becomes this kind of a conglomeration of these associations. Are making statements about yourself. And I think a lot of people don't have the, you know, the sophistication about just making sentences about yourself the way that one must do in resume construction.
Right. Well, do you have that architecture like behind you? Have you built that for yourself? Like, usually people will assemble it really quickly when they have a specific need, like when they have to talk about themselves in an interview or things like that. On my side of the world, when you're building this for business people or for people to use over and over again who are trying to get public notice so they can get their messages basically out for free, which is a massive advantage if you can make that happen. Like when you start constructing yourself, I build very specific pitch scripts for different target audiences and make them practice it so that it becomes, you know, instantly they can just snap their fingers and say that script. Because when people try to improvise their way through it, it's where they get into trouble. Because you have so much self back here, right? I mean, there's such a massive ocean of information behind you about you, and you can't improvise your way through that very well.
But knowing how to bullet point yourself is also, right? The same way as, you know, the professionals that, you know, here, give a quick talk about your research. So many of them can't do that. I can't get the, you know, 200 pages of my stuff into, you know, a 5-minute elevator pitch. So the picking and choosing. And so, yeah, people were lacking that kind of reflexive dimension. I've never really done this for myself or wanted to, I guess.
I'm theoretically aware of
what's going on. I'm a good critic of when other people are doing it.
It's funny though, like we're better at doing it for others than we are for ourselves. I can pitch you, if I'm like, oh yeah, I have this rhetoric podcast and one of the main guests is my friend Dave Payne, who's also my dissertation director. And I took tons of classes from him. He's a Burkean scholar and really smart guy. And there you go. I've just pinpointed you with what I would call star points that people can walk away with a positive expectation about you.
So, yeah, I could, I guess, just put smart guy.
Yeah, sure.
Well, I guess there's also a kind of a stage where you have to own up to these things, right? There was on your homepage or the page that pops up on your computer, whatever. There's a little pocket digest of readings that somebody's selected. Anyway, one of them this morning was about becoming a leader. Embrace the idea of being an imposter. I forget exactly the title, but that you have to get comfortable with the idea that you're an imposter, that you make these claims to being something, and you know, and that anybody in this kind of transitional phase of getting a new job or making public claims to being a leader. I mean, let's look at our political candidates right now, right? They have no presidential ethos. They have to fake that, right? They have to pretend that, you know, how would you act? How would you dress? What would you do to convince other people that you're presidential material? But not being a president, that none of them really have a clue. So that's part of the image manufacturing business that's going on. I once suggested
instead of debates, they should just have dance-offs. Well, like if you saw these people dance for 1 minute, you would know exactly who they are.
Sure. Well, it's too long of a story, but that's actually kind of a criterion in an oral culture. I think about the time that George Bush was, we had the video of him doing an African dance, and it was kind of the best image that he ever had, in my opinion, when it came right down to it.
Yeah, no, I think, again, we're not quite there yet in this discussion, but when you start traveling this stuff across cultures, like performative dance is one of the ways that you are vetted in other cultures.
Sure.
If you can't dance or you haven't worked on your dance skills, that's a clear indicator of, you know, character flaw.
Right. So, yeah, there are this requisite set of performances. But I suppose on the job interview, you're pulling some of them off to say, can you be cast in the role of whatever you're. So in a way, you are an imposter. But then I think about embracing your inner imposter, embracing your inner George Santos. Because you look at this and you go, how did anybody like that ever get elected to office, right? And he must be some kind of savant at just moving in and out of his imposter roles. So there is a far wall here somewhere that we may be exploring.
Yeah, I think the imposter angle into this is really interesting, especially theoretically, that everybody is suffering from imposter syndrome because identity itself as a concept doesn't really cover everything that you need it to be. Like, you need to be something in order to get a certain thing in the culture, and you don't quite have the ethos to get there, the credibility to get there. So you just fill it in until you do feel it. You know, or other people will recognize it.
Or you get caught, right? I mean, this is back to old sociology, the Goffman formulation, that people make a public claim about who they are. And your success as a person really depends on your ability to pull off those requisite performances. And of course, embarrassment occurs when somehow you're shown to be less than, or you're right. It's kind of the Bill Cosby problem, writ every day And that we all, how do we all suffer those embarrassments, and how do we make repairs on them? So that is kind of this, but I think this kind of gets amped up just in the, what we're talking about with image, right? Maintaining an image. How does one strike the pose of that kind of person? And that's kind of the foot in the door, I suppose, of what we're talking about.
Right, a lot of this stuff has become very, it's become very patterned, at least, especially visually. Like before we started this recording, we were working on getting you framed correctly so your head didn't get cut off, because that will lower your visual, your media credibility so far that people will just dismiss you and not watch.
I suppose media, I don't know what's the right word for it, appropriateness, media etiquette would be as much as going to a dinner party and wearing the right tie used to be, right?
Yeah, and people are so adept at reading, you know, the visuals of media. It's like, even I tell people with this podcast, like, it's clearly not lit correctly. I clearly don't really have a background. Sometimes I'm experimenting now again with the audio because my other computer broke, and so I don't know exactly how this audio is coming through. So, but if people see that, like, I think Elizabeth mentioned, like, Dan's kitchen. Where's Dan's kitchen in the background? Right. And I finally was like, oh, I should just move the angle so I get rid of the kitchen, because that's too dominant a symbol for people to take it out and listen to a rhetoric podcast.
But they, this can all be fixed. We can either make it Dan's kitchen as the frame of the whole thing, spiffy it up a little bit, or recast it somewhere else.
But you can't get around the fact that that's one of the things people have been super trained to, is the visuals themselves. And that's why, you know, so much of the celebrity work, the Kardashians and all that kind of stuff, it's, and politicians, Trump is, you know, because he's media trained and TV trained, he understood very quickly that it's just about getting one good picture. Like, it really doesn't matter anything else. People are not really going through the transcripts. They're not really processing the text. But they will process, you know, it goes back to the Reagan thing, right? The Reagan presidency, about, it's a visual presidency, produced visual presidency.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, I've never, I don't know how much Trump knows about what he's doing.
No, I think it's just training. He's been whipped around by the media enough that he knows, you know. Like, it's not genius. Everyone's like, oh, he's a genius. No, he's just been doing it for a long time with a bunch of directors.
Sure.
And they take out, the nice thing about working in the media and sort of big time media is they do all that for you, and they take out the mistakes before the public sees it. You know, if we actually got the tapes of Trump and all the things he said while he was on The Apprentice doing rehearsals, he would, you know, then we would actually have an authentic window into the Trump persona.
I think this came up when he was running, that there are all of these outtakes that are proprietary and deeply buried, and that if we had access to them, we would, you know, see him saying a lot of things that, of course, he seems to be able to say anything and get by with it, so who knows.
Yeah, but the secret of Trump is that the language choice. He never actually uses the devil terms all the way. Like, he's very good at never saying the completely heinous thing. Hints at it, points at it, euphemizes it, all that kind of stuff. But he never actually says, like, these trigger words. And it's amazing that he hasn't.
I would think.
Like, you heard him talk on the Entertainment Tonight tape, where he's like, grab a pussy, you know, I grabbed her, and there's the unvarnished language, which he clearly uses in his authentic real life, which is why I've always argued, like, as soon as you start running for any kind of public office, you have to wear a body cam 24/7. I want to hear everything you're saying and doing. I don't want to guess at it, guess whether you're honest. Like, that's horrible.
That's funny. Well, yeah, and I remember with that incident, then the immediate apology here was the reframing was, this is locker room talk. Even Melania repeated, well, this is locker room talk. Then they interviewed some of his fans, going, even women going, well, yeah, I talk that way. Everybody talks that. So, yeah.
Which is fine, but they don't, again, like, that one was misogyny. if it was racial, like if he had done that and released racial tapes like that, that would have been different.
Maybe. Although I think in a way his ability to speak in code about with those same racial attitudes is part of what's making it more.
He's still got to perform the code. He can't use the bare, you know, ugliness.
But once again, how does that shift in terms of our criteria? From, I mean, it would be at one point part of the ethical credibility, the performance requirements for a president to not say those things. In other words, to be able to pull off, the savoir faire so that would be the fact that one did those kinds of things in any kind of public setting would be disqualifying. So,
right, but it's no longer dignified.
I mean, the way he
right?
talks, you know, the way he talks about his opponents, the way he talks about the military. So I think there is this kind of this is a point of identification that how else does somebody like that pull off the idea that he is like his constituents, well, for whom he clearly has complete animosity. I have to shake hands with those people, right? So they somehow get the feeling that he is like them based on this kind of lack of sophistication. So I think
for a long time, American politics was dignitas, right? And Biden still plays this game. Talk with dignity, point to the higher morals and ideals and lofty language. And that's, you know, it was pretty easy to counter program that. Like Trump came in and was like, I'll just throw away around some of this basic talk. And that was enough to capture and, you know, a certain segment of people because, like you said, he's now performing something that's much more similar to the way they talk. They've never talked like Biden in their whole life.
Yeah, but once again, I'm not sure I want somebody to be able to make that kind of talk. I would consider that to be a skill. I'm not sure I want somebody that like me in those ways. So I think that is kind of a part of a media phenomenon, a media culture phenomenon, that we've got to that point where, at least for a certain percentage, they are what that bespeaks of more than more than their need for that, but their disdain for those other performances, the alienation they feel from the language of diplomacy or statesmanship or those formal languages where we at one time. When you go back and look at Kennedy's inaugural, they're still wearing top hats, right? No place else in the world are you wearing a top hat in 1960.
That's great. Yeah, I hadn't thought of that.
once again, those were ceremonial consummations of these kinds of public roles and identities that was deeply embedded in a certain kind of ritual and aesthetic. So how has that shifted? So I'm maybe this isn't where you want to go with it, but in talking about, you know, what are you trying to accomplish with these impositions, if that's what they are, these representations, if we move from image to avatar, with ethos, classically, you know, we kept kind of updating that word through the 40s, even though it comes from Aristotle, of course, but it really is a moral substance idea. Right. The original idea is, how do you communicate your morality? And we kind of updated that to be expertise or, you know, believability. But I guess in Greece, you'd want to know what you're talking about. But it's not a concept of being an expert. We weren't requiring that of speakers or leaders in that sense. Or nor do we really today. In fact, expertise is now one of these turnoffs. But so it really was a kind of a moral substance of, can you be trusted, right? And character, where are you from? Are you known? How are you known? Based upon your background, your family identity, your class, that sort of reliability indicator. So you're not just somebody who blew into town. And of course, that was the original rhetoric. How do you fake those kinds of, you know, construct through speech, those kinds of trustworthy characteristics? And we call that sophistry. And then rhetorical education through, you know, the mid part of the century, at least, was, well, basically, that's a good thing of citizenship and basic communication skills to be able to pull off, you know, the kind of requisite performances of right. So ethos became, right, how do I talk and be believed because I know what I'm talking about, and express, you know, friendliness and goodwill toward the audience, whatever. So something shifts when we're just talking about manipulating an identity that you're known and circulating that identity. And I really see this happening as much as any, although obviously it's happening more, but Jimmy Carter had this kind of public image crisis, I recall. So we're talking, you know, mid-70s. And he had to do an image makeover. So they actually, that this actually was a reported kind of event where we're going to take him and rehabilitate him in terms of how he's managing media. And then, of course, as you noted, Reagan was kind of the master of that. Talk about somebody trained.
Right.
And so it really was kind of a media presidency, and clearly, and you know, his advisors were talking about, yeah, forget what the newspaper article says. The picture that they published with it is really the dominant thing. That's what's going to, you know, stick here. So I just wonder how we have in a computer age or with a kind of accelerating that kind, those kinds of cultural shifts in what we expect. And the kinds of skills and performances we expect from leaders or coworkers or, you know, bosses, whatever. So you're trying to, I guess, find a way to, sorry about that, to simulate this somehow or to get a handle on it.
Well, again, you know, most people don't get any type of rhetoric training. Formal rhetoric training outside of their public speaking class, right? You know, importing things from writing is some of it too. But the sense of when you tell people you are about to walk out of your public identity, your private identity, which you've lived in forever. And of course, there are parts of that you hide. There are parts of this that you fake, all that stuff. But you're used to that world. You kind of know what that feels like until you wander into new people or new situations where they stress test you. And like, I'm not sure I believe that identity, and you have to perform it and prove it. But walking into the public, and a lot of people have gotten comfortable now because Instagram and Twitter and Facebook and all these places, TikTok, they go ahead and give you the models. They do the production for you. You can look really amazing on TikTok and Instagram because it's all built into the technology. They supply produced music to underlie, you know, put in as a bed to your videos. So these people look a lot better than they would just constructing themselves on their own. But when you're going to go over there and go, I want to grab some kind of effect from an audience, I want them to follow me or like me or buy my products or elevate me to this level of guru and, you know, all these different people competing for that throne, trying to get up there where they can be seen as somebody that's worthy to be paid and followed, then you have to turn to like the classical resources of rhetoric again. How do I come off as a good person here? How do I avoid being a scam, you know, labeled a scam artist? And I've seen a lot of this play out in sort of the therapy wars. How do you come raise yourself up as a therapy guru when you're still charging, when you're charging people? Because charging people moves you over into scam artist, you know, but over here, you're supposed to be compassionate and giving and trying to help the human race. And you got to start balancing these things. And so it becomes a rhetorical project.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's another stage in the fact that people wouldn't find that difficult is another commodification of self here, right? I mean, that we expect people to charge for these kinds of things.
Well, but they don't. People aren't really used to paying for professional communication construction.
Sure.
They're used to like, oh, you know, I'll just use what I've learned in my private life. I'm a decent communicator. I'll communicate like that in public. I'm like, that's what happened to Jimmy Carter. You know, he was not talking like a media president. His answers were incredibly long. His speeches were far too dense. All these things that, you know, and he's so muted when he talks and so Southern that it didn't fit the media environment that he was suddenly in. And so we're like, oh, we, this guy needs some different skills and different scripts. Let's get busy.
Right. Right. Well, you know, one thing that became of concern, and you alluded to this earlier about the kind of personal information that is around about people, in the kind of the Facebook, advent of Facebook culture was, well, these people are going to grow up and there's going to be all of this history, right? The things they posted, pictures of themselves at parties and, you know, things they've done, this sort of private, you know, or publicization of your private life as a friendship network. And all that stuff's around so that when, you know, you do job searches, people are going to look this stuff up. So don't you think we've kind of become a little bit more immune to this kind of, or accepting that there is this public-private split, so that the split itself is maybe something people have to manage? Just accept that the public performance is just that?
I think that's definitely one aspect of it that people accept, but it's also, you think about the Hillary Clinton emails, right? So the thing I think that got that to people is that it's this amorphous, unreachable information, which raises it up as this sort of mystery cache of what's in there, what has she done? And like Trump, I think, would have just been like, yeah, yeah, those are the emails. There you go. You know, I said all these horrible things. What are you going to do? Like, and she came from that sort of, again, sort of dignitas and that kind of politics of creating an image of yourself as this sort of moral hero. And that's got to be one of the reasons that she didn't want to release those, is there's probably stuff in there that made her look like a regular human being and saying regular human being things, and sort of broke that kind of constructed public identity. And I think people do have some maturity about what it means now, like what they should take away from what's released, but it's also become this massive war, this ethos war. Anything you release to the other side can be amplified into this dark cloak, and you've got to factor that into everything now. Like, I think that's the whole secret to the right. They're just a stain machine. They're just a slander machine, and anything that you give them, they're able to turn into a bonfire.
Well, that's kind of very topical this week with the Hunter Biden challenge. I will answer your question, but only in public, so that you can't make up stuff about what I said.
Exactly. Yeah. We need some kind of public record if we're going to talk to these people, because just letting them talk, again, my idea of 24/7 body cam, I don't need to hear your interpretation of what happened. I need to see what happened.
But see, I think you know, and I think the Hillary Clinton email thing was a progenitor to this. It was about, there must be something in there that is damning, but you begin with, as a conspiracy minded individual, with the idea that there is something damning to be found. People were coming up to me when the Hillary, oh, these emails are going to be released, and that were, there's stuff in there. There really wasn't, right? I mean, as far as we know, there really wasn't anything all that dramatic. And of course, the Hunter Biden laptop is the same kind of, you know, oh, there will be something in here. And now they spent 2 years looking for the you know, they found every other possible hideous thing, but nothing that shows that Joe was doing anything criminal. He's been charged with gun ownership, which for anybody else in this culture, however crazy or drunk they might be, would be heroic.
Yeah, they said it's never been charged before, that you were on drugs while you bought a gun. It's like, welcome to Alabama.
You know? Kind of mandatory. I've moved to a community where apparently the story about this place is that it is in the city ordinance that you must own a weapon. I guess it's not enforced. So
that's funny.
It is funny.
When you touched on conspiracy, this idea of conspiracy of self, right? That you present a certain self in public, but I know there's more there about you. And I want to see that. And if you don't show it to me, I will, again, import the darkest, craziest, Pizzagate, blood drinking pedophiles, and you can't defend yourself against that.
Well, certainly with the leaders, I mean, once again, their image and their credibility is impaled on these pre-existing alignments and conspiracies. So, I mean, the kinds of stuff that they, if you take what was known about Joe Biden, oh, he's the nicest guy. You got the Lindsey Graham tape. Oh, he's, you know, he's the sweetest man in the world, no matter what else you say about, you know, you got all of that background that's just been the regular Joe and good meaning Catholic sufferer of great family tragedy. And you take all of that away, you know, the one thing that was said about him was, here's a man who's never made a dime in politics, and now he is the head of the Biden crime family to a certain segment. I mean, he's been morphed by all of, by exactly what you were talking about, this idea that there must be something in there, the certainty that the evil is lurking there, and we're going to find that out. So I don't know how to ratchet that down into, you know, the kind of things that we as regular human beings, but I tend to think, you know, those kinds of identifiers really are practical, real situations in talking to people these days. I mean, I've had a few of, you know, sort of where we're being friendly and then people find, you know, sort of imagine, or they betray a certain political orientation, and all of a sudden we can no longer, you know, pursue this. I imagine in the dating world, which I'm completely alien to, this is huge, right?
Yeah, people use it as a disqualifier up front. It's very common, especially out here in California, to read online dating profiles that say no Trumpers.
Well, or the Boebert film of her in the movie theater acting up and her reporting at the end of this. The thing I learned from this is don't date a Democrat. She hadn't checked the political alignment of the guy she was.
My favorite line from her was, the last time I dated, they didn't have infrared cameras in theaters.
That's funny.
But well, you get this idea of like self becomes this conflicted space. It's conflicted personally, like your identity. Like, who am I? Like, I have a 21-year-old son, and I'm having lots of conversations with him now about, you know, who he is and what makes him happy and what doesn't and what should he do. And, you know, he's processing himself over and over and over. And he's like, don't you do this? Like, how come you don't? And I'm like, I did that. Like, I remember my 20s. Like, I kind of reached some conclusions of I may not be good at these things. Fine. That's not my thing. These are things I'm good at. These are things I like to repeat. And I've processed, but you know, it kind of fascinates him or freaks him out. He doesn't believe you can not really process yourself the way he's doing it right now.
And how is he doing it? I mean, how do you contrast that?
Well, he's got a mother who's a psychotherapist, and right, his company, you know, has benefits. So he's been going to a therapist, and it's just that kind of sense of, why aren't I happy enough? Or why don't I have this or this? And then he goes back and starts reinterpreting his past. It's all through that psychoanalytic cloud, you know, that particular therapeutic terminology cloud. And he doesn't like it when I point out that it's a terminological cloud that he's in.
Well, it's another technology of self-construction.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. A strong one, too. Like, a lot of people have it.
You know, I'm thinking about Philip Reeve's book, The Age of the Therapeutic, right? Or The Therapeutic Age. It is itself part of the terminological, the rhetoric, call it what it is, that ushers in this age of self-manufactured, self-created identity. So you come to this reconciliation with your inner stuff, whatever it is, and then somehow the ethical obligation is to turn that into an outward set of performances. And we call that authenticity. And so, so authenticity, because now I think we may be entering the kind of the George Santos phase where authenticity maybe isn't that. we would hope for maybe a little consistency, but even that seems a lot to ask. People are asking, how do you play in this sort of strategic matrix? So it is becoming very performance-based and transactional.
And it's fascinating as it moves across different situations. Like, when I worked in stand-up, I worked a lot. I ran a lot of workshops and comedy clubs for early stand-ups who are trying to get in and do things. And I would give them advice. A lot of times the workshops are before the open mic night. So they would come and go through the workshop, and then they'd do a set that night. And I would be like, that thing that you're thinking about doing isn't going to work. And they would be like, uh-huh. And then they would go up and do it. So they would do that rhetorical performance and it would die. And you would just see it in their eyes like, oh, I was wrong about what I am in this moment, what I'm bringing to this moment. And it was such a beautiful way of teaching because they got the instant feedback for their choice from a completely neutral party of 200 people. And there was no questioning the evidence. I'm like, yeah, they didn't laugh at that. They laughed at these three things. And stand-ups get shaped by that, where, you know, they end up sort of moving towards the response to their performance. And in some ways, you know, the audience kind of shapes who that person is going to be in public. But it was such a perfect, brilliant, instant feedback loop that you never get, you know, when you're outside of those kind of settings.
Yeah, I see. You know, there are these kinds of, and I'm an amateur, but I am a great fan of comedy and stand-ups. There do seem to be those kinds of caricatures that, you know, the Emo Phillips kind of artificial caricature that is itself comedic. But then there seems to also be, and maybe these are the therapeutic comics, I don't know, who I think a lot of female comedians fall into this category, but also think about Marc Maron. I just watched the streamed version of Mike Birbiglia. I don't know if you're familiar with him at all.
Yeah, Birbiglia.
But they somehow these accessing their inner self, their private self, and that seems to be the wellspring of their comedy. I suppose Woody Allen would be kind of a...
Yeah, it definitely emerged as a strong thing in stand-up of self-report and confession and self-ethnography on stage. And it's huge. It's still like it probably, I don't know, 70% of comics, maybe more. That's what they do now, is they self-report.
Or Amy Schumer, that's just sort of, you know, she's her own shock jock kind of, right? Or Sarah Silverman, who's brilliant at it.
And then people ask me again the sort of selving questions, the identity questions, even within stand up. They're like, oh, I like this guy. And I'm like, yeah, he's not really like that in real life. You know that, right? And they're like, what do you mean? I'm like, well, like that's a character, that's a performance. Sometimes it's an element of who they are, but it's an enhanced element for stage. Almost nobody I know goes on stage as who they are off stage.
Sure.
Because that public theater demands more.
The presence of an audience, absolutely. Yeah. And always going for the effect, right? That's, like you say, the learning, well, yeah, the learning here is what creates the effect.
Well, and that's ultimately, you know, it comes back to rhetoric that you need to be effective. You need to win the moment. And people will import all these techniques in order to do that. And then they'll end up feeling inauthentic. You look at like the Robin Williams phenomenon of, you know, you have this trope in comedy of the sad clown. And here's a guy who suffered from depression for a long time, but was the most manic character, one of the most manic characters in history when he was publicly performing. And every time I met the guy, he was in his, you know, other side of the trope where he was very introverted and very quiet and nice and things like that. But that's not the Robin Williams that other people would ever sign off on. They were so, you know, aghast that, oh my God, I never knew he was suffering. Like there was no suffering in him at all. So which was the authentic Robin? You know, was it the private self that had these sort of ghosts and depression, or was it this public self that was a manic, loved character by millions, if not billions of people? Which was Robin?
So is that the vision? Is that accessible to, I mean, can you translate that into sort of what are these identity requirements these days that the people need to fill? Is there a certain kind of quota of personal information that and disclosure that is required to become an authentic, believable character? Because I do think the criteria is kind of, you know, in this environment, can I believe you are who you say you are is kind of a question, right? But there's also then kind of the imposter question, you can play that role, but are you going to be effective?
It's interesting too, though, like when you say that, like there's the disclosing the private self, and hopefully it matches enough to the public self, but it's more like performing or mimicking the expected self in performance, especially in theater. Like, and I guess even when we start to break it down, like all the TikTokers, like there was a thing this week that TikTok has created its own semantics, its own grammar. Like they all sound alike. They all deliver things in about the same way. They all perform it about the same way. There's become a grammar of TikTok. And people are like, where did it come from? I'm like, yeah, where did it come from? Like, and there's, I see this a lot in stand-up where a lot of the locals in an area will start to all sound alike. There's a comic now, Shane Gillis, who is a little bit of a different delivery, holds the mic real close like this and has a kind of disassembled way of performing. And I'm starting to see now the younger comics all doing him.
Hmm.
And it's that kind of, I'm going to inhabit this shell of self that I know works in public over here because I've seen it work and I like it. So that's my model now, and I'll just transport myself into that model. And there's definitely a strategy, and I see it a lot in business. Like all the business people that I work with, they start out, they kind of all sound exactly the same. The leadership thing you were talking about earlier, you know, like that, all the buzzwords and this sort of extreme positivity and all the things that make up a business person, become very strong models and scripts for how people feel like they have to talk in public.
I think it's probably to some degree true of almost every walk of life, whether you're a lawyer or certainly think about your teaching style as an amalgamation of all the teachers you mm-hmm. liked, right? And you borrow stuff from. And so there is this kind of, you know, I think imitation is the basis of all art, really. So, and originality is really very difficult.
Well, you mentioned teachers. Just think about the identity restrictiveness on teachers. Like you can only be certain selves in the classroom. There are narrow parameters.
Yeah.
They will get you instantly banished if you are performing that self in a classroom.
Right. Well, I used to tell beginning teachers, I said, don't worry, you've never taught before, but they've been students for 12 years. They're going to turn you into the teacher by the end of the term, right? Well, they may be painful. There may be a lot of rejection along the way, but they will eventually turn you into the teacher, whether you want to be or not. So this idea, I'm going to be different than, or buddy-buddy, or whatever. No, there's enough institutionalized situations, and they know the rules perfectly well. So it is a situation where you very much are controlled by the audience.
Yeah, and that's why self becomes these sort of mini archetypes, right, within these institutions. Like, what kind of teacher am I going to be? Am I going to be the cool, friendly teacher? Am I going to be the aloof expert? Am I going to be the domineering? Am I going to be the compassionate? Like, there's a wheel of options, essentially.
Right, but not that many that work. I mean, I see people going through a kind of an ontogeny of those developments. I'm gonna try to be this, and then I'm gonna be the expert. No, they don't want that at all, right? Then they will turn into the meaningful, helpful, coaching, concerned individual.
Well, and that's what I see performed in the coaching profession and business, and that people are selling a lot on Instagram is this kind of balance between I have this super expertise, this secret expertise that you've never heard before, even though it's all regurgitated, recycled, you know, from like person-centered therapy and things like that. And over here, it's I care about you so much. You know, I'm here. I'm ready to bring you into the fold. And they've got to do that dual expert compassion thing. You see people when it implodes, like with the Bikram yoga. I don't know if you remember this. There's a great documentary about Bikram. He created this hot yoga and this 21 things, and he basically stole it from somewhere else, but he adapted it and had his own way of doing it. Big time marketer. It took over the world, massive brand. He's at the center of it. And then it starts to leak out. Oh, he's having, you know, sex with all his students and forcing them and coercing them. And, you know, just all implodes because you can't make those two things compatible in one, you know, sort of concerned, compassionate semi-deity.
Right. Well, yeah, I mean, there are, you know, we still are exercising a certain amount of moral criteria here.
a lot.
The ability of people to sustain the dualism is never ceases to amaze me.
I think about politicians sometimes and
preachers. You know,
all that stuff. Like if you are running the moral character, like I am the, and people, I wrote this thing this week about Trump. People still like, how can people still be attached to him? I'm like, well, to me, he's got the ultimate character piece that MAGA wants above all else. It doesn't matter, which is infidel killer. Like he is promising to kill off their entire category of infidel, which is new people, change, new races, new ways of doing things, anything new and different or that challenges their power structure, he will attack. And so that's, to me, the ultimate character that he's portraying that trumps everything else.
Yeah, I mean, and maybe it doesn't matter whether he actually does this or not. The fact that he's naming,
he just promises to do it.
He's giving the correct name, and he may, you know, he may not be doing anything more original than kind of overhearing what people say at the water cooler. But he is voicing that. So there is this kind of, you know, deep pantheology of demons, right? Pantheon of demons that occupy that ideology, and he names them and promises to you know, he's going to save us because he will cast them out. And it's really been interesting lately, you know, that he's kind of digging up old files, like we've got to replace Obamacare, you know, and there's almost no memory apparently about this stuff. Surely some people are noticing that was exactly the same mantra as 7 years ago.
I don't know. Like he is going back to, he's got greatest hits and he does them over and over again. You know, this was it a month ago or so where he just directly resurrected Nazi terminology of vermin. Like right. We have to get rid of these vermin, like liberals, like it's literally instead of Jews or immigrants or whatever that he wants to put in there, it's now liberals, which is totally attackable. It's such an abstract. You can say the worst thing you want to say about a liberal.
Know. Well, but he went on to label the kind of the same, you know, almost like really verbatim of a Hitler speech about it's the intellectuals, it's the liberals, it's the communists, it's the Marxists, it's the
right, the whole litany, you know, of villains.
We're going to get rid of them all. We're going to get rid of them all.
Left-out villains.
And you're right. He stopped short of saying what really is, and the gay people and the trans people and the right. But I think he's speaking in that code. I tend to think about that. I mean, I'm always curious when these attributions to Trump as speaker get made. I think there's a fair suspicion that one can have that somebody like Steve Bannon actually wrote that speech, and Trump will say anything with him not even being aware that he's, you know, quoting Hitler. But Bannon is aware. Whoever wrote that is completely aware of what they're doing, right? So.
Yeah, it was totally, you could tell, like it, that one was scripted because it was too.
Yeah, the way he's performing when he does those are scripted moments, right? When he speaks slowly and, you know, it's not part of his stand, what you correctly identified as a stand-up comedy routine.
Yeah, it's very routine is, that's why people don't understand about Trump is that he's just a trained public character. Like he's just very good at staying on script. Like if you tell him to be the villain and that's effective for him, that's what he's going to do. Every once in a while in his like CPACs or his kind of side talks, you can see a little bit of him coming in there where he'll be like he called somebody a motherfucker, kind of muttered it, you know, and he'll start using some of his real terminology, but the guy stays on script, which was Biden's superpower too. He's such a trained, you know, left wing politician for talking about the America and we're all here together and let's make this work, and such discipline during the campaign. Like Trump couldn't get him out of it, which was pretty impressive. So let's wrap this back into this idea of personal identity and public identity. I always like to see if I can get you to talk about your own personal experience with this. Where do you see your junctures there? Because you were a public character within an institution for a long time. And
heavily institutionalized, sure.
Yeah.
Where do I see it?
Like, do you see, like, the institution, was that close to your authentic self? Like, I've known you in both contexts for a long time. It doesn't seem like there's a huge disjuncture between who you were as a professor and who you are as a person.
Not a lot, but I think the classroom where I did well, especially the graduate classroom, offers a fair bit of freedom, as long as you're bringing the goods in some kinds of ways. Right. So I think, you know, if you think back, I've had conversations over years about famous, you know, professor. What professor do you remember from your undergraduate? And a lot of them had a real serious gimmick, right? It's kind of like a lot of them are along the lines of the old Clarence Darrow, right, of the cigar that he would put a wire in the ash, and so that it would burn down, so everybody was paying attention to, you know, that ash and when it's going to drop, right? So I think a lot of the professorial devices are of that character, these quirks that are, you know, I remember a bunch of us in graduate school keeping a daily record of how many times the professor used the phrase, keep in mind. We called it the Kim score, right? So we would compare after class the Kim score for that day. He did it 23 times or whatever. So I think a lot of those, it's a place where quirks are marketable, let's put it that way. And they're attentional devices because, of course, in teaching, the problem here is, you know, you can't really maintain without, like, stand-up comic skills anybody's attention for an hour, right, or an hour 15 minutes, let alone three. So I think all of those things obtain. So I imagine part of it is just cultivating your personal. That's why it isn't that much different than regular identity. Certainly there's moves here when you go into, you just don't have to be, you develop those over time. And once again, I think you develop them as a kind of a head of glossy of those that came before you. You pick up stuff.
I always think it's funny too, when it works backwards. Like when I first left teaching and started working in Hollywood on writing staffs, it's a semi-intellectual atmosphere. Those guys are smart. They're educated. People are talking about topics and issues. And this one guy, Josh David, fun writer, used to tease me all the time. It'd be like, I would make a point about something. He's like, thanks, professor. Thanks for the micro lecture today. And I'm like, God, I can't stop it. I cannot.
And that is telling the tale. The things I've noticed over the years, especially when I do consulting or meet with other public leaders in some kind of fashion, what's your role there, and what do they think about professors? How poorly most of that stuff plays anywhere else outside of the classroom. And of course, there are those few professors that are really glib and good with public audiences. But they tend to wear thin as professors. I mean, they're you know, it's a true gifted person that can pull all of that off. But that is the thing to me, is that you get into those habits of what your attitude is and how you're dancing that attitude. And, you know, you come off as smug or pompous and without ever meaning to at all. I mean, you might be trying to be the most gracious person in the world, but, you know, you're performing this expertise that, anyway, all right. So
that's what I learned just a long time ago with entertainment, again, because I moved back and forth through both these worlds for a long time, working in both of them, you know, in academics and in entertainment. I would go and do bar comedy at night after, you know, lecturing during the day. And when I would do media, a lot of times I realized, man, I want to turn things into small dissertations, into small turns, longer turns. And that doesn't work in the media. And then they would get feedback from like listeners, same thing. I was very well-meaning. Somebody asked me a question. I was trying to give them a good answer. And people would be like, he thinks he knows everything. I'm like, you just don't have a category for a public expert. Like, it doesn't, you don't really want that. You want, you know, sort of pundits and like glib one-liners, but you don't want any kind of a detailed explanation. And I had to learn that, and I ended up scripting all the answers. So like when people ask me about rhetoric, I'm like, yeah, the Greeks invented it the same time they invented democracy, because democracy makes things a mess. And turns out like you got to study it. And so, you know, all these sort of one-liners, and I've just got a probably 50 or 100 of them now that I use when I do media. because people can't take like that little 2-minute answer that I gave right there.
Well, I think, you know, once again, to kind of arc back to the practical and everyday and generally applicable, it's about role, right? In a literal dramatic sense, that these roles come with scripted kinds of speeches, and they play for an audience. I'm trying to recall what I heard somebody say. They used to talk about in politics. A dismissive term would be, this is kabuki theater, right? Which is elemental, just the mass, right? But now it's not kabuki, it's, and I can't remember exactly what they were trying to substitute, but something along the order of, you know, clown curves or something like
right.
that. But in a way, that's I think what we're talking about in terms of, I would think in terms of the kind of decision tree or structure that you're trying to bring to how people do self-presentation for general audiences in a mediated environment, an online environment, that it's being conscious of role and impression management, right? And how does one, you know, cut away the noise, whether that be individual and personal or just sort of idiosyncratic to the role. And I think, once again, these days, one has to perform or represent sort of the human being. And we also, we've talked a lot about the kind of what do they call that? When we're supposed to no longer be able to distinguish between AI and reality.
Deep fakes.
Well, that's part of it. But there's kind of a convergence. I forget the technical term that they're talking about, where there just won't be any difference. This is something that...
Well, and that's the next step in all this identity work is, once you dump AI into it and it starts to learn how to construct personality and how to deconstruct personality, like, it's going to do crazy things to people's... markers, you know, for the things that they use to try to decide identity of other people. All that stuff's going to get shifted horribly because it's no longer going to be trustable.
Right. But like many politicians, AI can already invent a personal story to humanize whatever it's trying to talk about, right? It can already, I don't know, I read something about Joe Biden's lies, and they tend to not be these huge, you know, prevarications like Trump. They tend to be these inventions, the biographical service of inventions. And my daddy always said, I think
right.
It was that's when you know when he's lying, is when he always brings in one of these in the conversation. I don't know whether that's true or not, but that was what was being represented in the piece.
It's going to become a wild west. It really is, especially for somebody.
But
you are
talking about a kind of a politics of self, and I think maybe that's kind of where all these roads are that we stumble down in this conversation lead to, is that there is a sort of a political strategic dimension and the criteria, the credibility judgment that's getting made about you isn't so much, is that truly who you are? Is this where you came from? And can I trust your identity? Because I'm not really invested in that. All I want to know is this useful and strategic?
Yeah.
So that's another meta layer of sophistication. That's a new sophism.
Yeah.
In classical rhetoric terms, you'd call it a new sophistic.
Yeah, it's going to be fascinating. I mean, the rhetorical self... The self that a rhetoric approach will sort of manufacture out into the world. You know, I think it has that, and this is why I always talk about identity as well. Like, rhetoric has to talk about all that therapeutics and the psychology of this stuff and the authenticity of this stuff, but also it's manufacturing versions of you and shoving those out into people's faces in order to get effect. And trying to do so ethically or in ways that aren't dangerous to what you're claiming and can't be disproven by the other side. It becomes this sort of very interesting rhetorical location. And if you win it, Like the upsides are huge, but they can always be ripped away if somebody can come in and change your identity, you know, from a competitor, you know, standpoint. If I can suddenly go, oh, you know, and just pull the thread, you just disassemble in front of everybody.
Well, I do think that finding ways to signify that you're actually an embodied human will be important to this mix, right? And there are already occasions, right, that have come up where people, either through a phone call or online or whatever, have to find a way to signify that they're really a flesh and blood person. And we may, of course, arrive at the point where nobody cares, but.
Maybe, yeah. Maybe it'll be less a less viable space, so people stop relying on it so much. I tell people a lot of times when I do persuasion consulting with them for businesses, I'm like, if you win the ethos game, all the other games go away. Like nobody really wants to do logos vetting on you and all your claims and all your products and all that. They want to just believe in you. So like Apple has won the ethos game with technology, and it comes down to like, it's expressed in such a succinct way of, yeah, Apple stuff just works. It's more expensive, but it just works. Like, you know, you were working on your laptop, we couldn't get it to work, throw an iPad on there and it just works. And that's ultimate ethos technology win in the world. And Apple has won that.
Right.
Yeah.
I don't know if this is where you were or not, but as you're, you know, I kept thinking about channeling your inner George Santos. One asked the question, who gave you $25,000? There were like two people, and it had to be, I don't care about any of that other stuff. You, what you're saying right now in the here and now. So you're naming the right things. You're talking the right things in this situation with this audience, that somebody would write a check for $25,000, which I guess he promptly put in his personal account. So it must once again be, have no verification, no identity, no reality outside that particular transaction. And I guess that's ultimately, you know, we might as well talk about the history of con art, right?
Right. Yeah.
What you're creating is confidence.
So many different meteors flying into this topic. It really is endless identity, but, well, it's been super fun. I totally appreciate your perspective on this stuff. Some really good stuff in there.
Well, maybe, I don't know. We just rattled around.
Hey, that's what the whole podcast is about. Just pick a topic and wander in and say some rhetorical things. So I like it.
Well, you know, and I think the other part of this, whatever truths we may have stumbled across or touched upon dug up to for further investigation, there is a reflexive side of this, is that who we are to ourselves, for ourselves, you know, has been nurtured by public identity and role. And I think a lot of this has a kind of a potentially psychological effect of eroding that level of satisfaction and intimacy. And I just, a little datum here, the World Health Organization has announced that loneliness is pandemic.
Right.
The greatest health threat now, equivalent to smoking a half a pack of cigarettes a day or something like that. And to think about mental health in those kinds of terms, are we asked, you know, why are people acting the way they're acting in on airplanes? Or why are people picking up guns and shooting people in grade school? There is something that is not being nourished by our social lives, and I think I think it's got a border or a butt, this set of issues that we're talking about somehow, because there is this kind of reflexive dimension to the, if you get back to the old existential literature, whereas I started stumbling down these hallways many years ago, about our crises of performances and our passages. And how we work, both the public and private, not in separate realities, are not in just reconciled realities, but they are mutually sustaining. It's just that the situations in which we have to gain those kinds of, both in, you know, in family and church and in school and public life, are being eroded by these technological
Now I think that's a it's a nice little summary. While you're saying it, I was thinking about the fact that next time you do one of the podcasts, because you're getting your knee replaced on next week, that you'll be a little bit less human.
Well, I certainly will be more cyborg than I have been. You know, I've avoided wristwatches.
You're gonna be like 0.1%.
I'm a little more wed to my external communication organ than I used to be.
So you're slowly being absorbed into the cyborg.
I've often thought of it as an external communication organ, and more and more, I can't be found without it. I can't even get into my apartment without the damn telephone, right?
I look forward to you going through your surgery, getting your new knee, come back a little bit less human, but still be Dr. Payne.
Well, I'll be able to walk more places. I guess this is back to effectiveness is the criteria. So I'll be less human in more places than I currently.
But you're retaining your humanness of being able to walk. Like, you know, you lose every time you lose a capacity as a human being, it alters who you think of yourself. And like I said, all these super.
I know. Yesterday, I put tennis balls on my walker. I have to have a walker to survive this, apparently. And Elizabeth said, "You seem to be depressed." I said, "Well, yeah. I think putting tennis balls on the legs of the walker was kind of a moment of passage here." So
that's a big moment. Yeah, funny. All right. Well, appreciate it. We will come back around and talk some more. This has been the Rhetoric Warriors podcast. Get out there, persuade people. It's always kind of interesting.